Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from MathWorks, a company accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Stick around until the end of this episode for a special segment about how companies like Nuvera Fuel Cells use MathWorks software to design engineered systems powering the clean energy transition.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Dr. Anthony Fauci served as the head of the National Institute for Allergies and Infectious Diseases from 1984 to 2022. He was an advisor to every U.S. president since Ronald Reagan, and that put him at the center of efforts to combat diseases that transform the public health and politics of this country, from the HIV/AIDS epidemic in the 1980s to the COVID pandemic beginning in 2020, where he served as one of the lead members of the White House COVID Task Force under then-President Donald Trump. Dr. Fauci writes about those experiences in his new memoir, On Call, A Doctor's Journey in Public Service. Dr. Fauci, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
You know, I have to say, I face a little challenge here, Dr. Fauci, because it will be impossible to satisfactorily summarize a 40-plus year career, but we're going to do our best, okay?
So,
I want to start off with, obviously, the period that you have frequently said really defines your medical career, and that's the work that you did on HIV/AIDS in the 80s and 90s. Could you start with a story of one particular person that you treated? His name in the book is Ron Rinaldi, and he obviously had AIDS. He was being treated in the hospital by you. He suffered from, he also had something called the cytomegalovirus, and you tell the story about one day what changed in Ron between morning rounds and evening rounds when you saw him again. Can you tell us that?
Yeah, that was a very dramatic and moving part of my journey in HIV, which was a 40-plus year journey. And Ron, which is not his real name because I wanted to maintain the confidentiality of the patient, Ron was a patient who had full-blown AIDS, very advanced disease, a wonderful young man who we got to know, my staff and I, who had a complication, an opportunistic infection, as you mentioned, called cytomegalovirus, which can affect multiple organ systems, but particularly is damaging because it infects the retina of the eye and can progressively eat away at the retina and cause blindness. So we had Ron in the hospital for a while, and he was gradually losing his vision. And I relate in the memoir that on rounds, my colleague and I, Cliff Lane, would make rounds with him, and he would look up at us in the morning. And you generally make rounds in the morning and in the evening, although if the patients need you, you come into the room anytime on an ad hoc basis. But in our morning rounds, we'd go in and say, "How are you?" He'd say, "Fine, nice to see you." Come back in the evening, same thing, "Fine, nice to see you." But in one particular day, as his vision was becoming worse and worse, we came in the morning, and he looked up and said, "Hi, Dr. Fauci. Hi, Dr. Lane. Nice to see you guys. How you doing? Have a good day. We'll see you later in the day." And then that evening, when we came into rounds, I walked into the room in the bed and looked straight at him, and he looked at me and said, "Who's there?" And that was like getting a crunch to my stomach, because it was clear that in the time between morning rounds and evening rounds, his cytomegalovirus had knocked out the last remaining sight component of his retina, and he was completely blind.
You were already...
Tragically, he died within a few months thereafter.
That section of the book really stopped me in my tracks because, I mean, you were already, at that point, seeing so much death, right? Because the fatality rate from AIDS was so high at the time. But there was something about that moment where Ron lost his sight. I mean, in the book, you're right, you had to work really hard to constrain your emotions. And then after you left the room, you burst into tears. What was particularly painful about that?
What was particularly painful was not only feeling a great deal of empathy for Ron, who we got to know well because, you know, he was a patient of ours for several weeks, almost up to a month at that point. But it just impressed upon me the frustration and at the time, hopelessness, which fortunately over the next few years turned into a great victory for biomedical research and the development of the drugs. But during that period, it just emphasized for me as I walked out of the room, went down the hall and turned the corner and went into my office, which was literally 100 feet from the clinical wards. I just felt a profound feeling of despair and pain that no matter what we did to try and help Ron, the disease was relentless, and because we didn't have any therapy at the time, there was really not much we could do but metaphorically put a Band-Aids on hemorrhages, which was not working.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how you write in the book about the reason why you got deeply interested and then deeply committed to doing research on HIV/AIDS. It started with a couple of articles in the CDC's MMRW, I believe, if I remember that correctly. But it was kind of an interesting leap that you took into a field for a disease that at that time was as far as we knew, was infecting a small number of gay men in America and could have been easily ignored. And it was by most in the medical profession. So why did you want to end up dedicating a huge chunk of your career to it?
Well, it was a combination of events. As I describe in the memoir, I had just come back in 1972 from the final year of my clinical training in New York City at New York Hospital. As a chief medical resident in internal medicine. And from 1972 to 81, I had a rather successful trajectory of my career. I was fortunate enough with a combination of, you know, a really good, generous mentor and an opportunity to treat formerly fatal diseases. I developed some therapies that induced remission in about 93% of people with this autoinflammatory disease called vasculitis, which was an inflammation of the blood vessels in the body that led to multiple organ system failure. So I was doing very well. But then when I saw the first cases of what turned out to be AIDS, we didn't know it was HIV yet because it was only 1981 in the summer. I read this MMWR that had five cases of, very curiously, all gay men who had previously been well, who had died from a very strange pneumonia called pneumocystis, which really attacks only people with very compromised immune systems. I thought it was a fluke, to be honest with you, or truth be told, and I just put it aside. And then a month later, in July of 1981, another MMWR, which is a report from the CDC, which talks about the surveillance of new diseases, now 26, again, not only curiously, but amazingly, all young, otherwise previously healthy gay men, not only from LA, but from San Francisco and New York City, who had a disease that was destroying their immune system. Not only did they have pneumocystis, but they had Kaposi sarcoma, a rare tumor seen only in immunocompromised people, and a number of other opportunistic infections. It was that sitting in my office in July of 1981 that, quite frankly, and I don't mean to be melodramatic, actually transformed my entire medical career because I made a decision then that this mysterious disease had to be a brand new disease. And it had to be an infection because epidemiologically, it was acting like a sexually transmitted disease because of the circumstances of the infections of the people who were reported. And certainly it was destroying the immune system. I had been trained in multiple years as a board-certified internist, a board-certified infectious disease person, and a board-certified clinical immunologist. And I felt, oh my goodness, this is a brand new disease. And no matter how successful my career had been at this point, I felt an absolutely overwhelming, compelling need to study the disease. Yeah. So I completely turned around the direction of my career. I put together a small group of people who were training with me, and we started bringing in, one after the other, a large number of these, which at the time still were almost exclusively young gay men with this disease, which was devastating them because it was killing them literally within 10 months.
So, Dr. Fauci, there's so much that I want to discuss about the challenges that you faced after having made that decision. And by the way, I appreciate your understatement about the successes you had had before that, by the way, in your career, because those successes included turning the fatality rate of vasculitis, I believe, from it was like very like 90%+ fatality. You turned that around to 90%+ survival rate with the new treatments that you had come up with. So but the thing is that the reason why HIV/AIDS is so transformative, not just for your career, but for the country, is that not only was it a novel disease, a novel virus, but it challenged us politically as a country. And you faced a lot of heat from across the board as you were, you know, working on trying to find a cure for HIV, including from the gay community. So let me just play a little quick clip here. This is from a community meeting you had in New York with a group of gay men early in the AIDS crisis.
Here, now that's wrong. And
you keep saying I'm wrong.
I'll tell you why you're wrong.
For the data.
You see, this is what I mean. You make a presumption, and I'll tell you why you're absolutely wrong.
Where is
with all
it?
Due respect.
Where is it?
You go to a phone, you dial 1-800-TRIALS-AIDS, and you ask them to send it to your home, and they will send you a packet of the data on that. The data is available. We'll give you the data. I promise you, we'll give you the data. Do you think that there's some conspiracy? You don't think it exists? So why do you want to?
Do I think there's a conspiracy? Yes, I do think there is still conspiracy really to not help in a lot of different ways.
So, Dr. Fauci, that's a very young you. and the AIDS activists who were accusing you of, or accusing NIH also, and the Allergies and Infectious Diseases of not providing data to activists on AIDS. I'm going to ask you to hold your thought there because we have to head into a quick break. But when we come back, I want to hear from you about the lessons that you learned in dealing with the public and dealing with politicians when trying to confront and find a cure for a radical and new disease. So that's what we'll talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. Are you hiring? With Indeed, your search is over. Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Support for this podcast comes from MathWorks, the leading developer of mathematical computing software that accelerates innovation by allowing companies to test technology virtually.
They're able to understand how that system's going to work before they start to begin building hardware systems.
Stick around until the end of this episode for a special segment about how model-based design is helping engineers, scientists, and academics solve today's energy challenges.
You're back with On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and Dr. Anthony Fauci joins us today. His new memoir about his 40-plus years in public service is called On Call, A Doctor's Journey in Public Service. And Dr. Fauci, I'd love to hear your recollections of either that specific meeting that we just played a moment from, where AIDS activists are really confronting you about not being able to get data and even accusing you or the public health establishment of a kind of conspiracy to not help them. I mean, what did you learn in, you know, those many quite heated meetings that you had back then?
Well, the bottom line of what I learned was something really important in my own development as a physician dealing with patients on an individual basis, but certainly on a broader, more generic public health. basis is to listen to what the patient's needs are. So let me explain as briefly and succinctly as I can. What happened is that with HIV and AIDS, the activist community was looking at their own personal situation, and the scientific community and the regulatory community, NIH, CDC, FDA, we were doing things that were well established over decades and decades that served the public very well. Very strict, rigid criteria and entry and exclusion criteria for clinical trials, the way research agenda is set, the care and meticulousness but long period of time that it takes to approve a drug worked well for other diseases but was particularly ill-suited for HIV, where the people who became clinically ill had a median of 10 to 15 months to live. And the system just didn't work for them. So they tried to get the attention of the community, the scientific and regulatory community, and was saying, we want to be part of the process. We want to see the data. We want to be part of the design of the clinical trials. We want to have input into the FDA's decisions about how long it takes them to approve a drug. And understandably, but completely inappropriately now retrospectively, the scientific and regulatory community said, well, we know what's best for you because we've been doing this for a long time. Mm-hmm. Well, that didn't sit very well with the activist community, who at the time were almost exclusively all young gay men. So they began to do things to make sure we understood that they were serious. They became iconoclastic, disruptive, theatrical, and confrontative. And they attacked us. But since I was a very visible public figure, because I was one of the few people that was very proactively working on their behalf, even though to them sometimes it didn't appear that way, they started attacking me publicly. The scene you just played was when I really extended myself. I went down essentially alone with one of my staff to the Greenwich Village Gay and Lesbian Community Center, sat down with them, about 100 of them, just alone and unprotected, and said, okay, let's hear what you have to say. And that exchange that you just played got a bit heated, but after a while, we began to talk to each other in a way that became very, very productive. So I was the first person to essentially sit down and speak with the activists who were being disruptive as opposed to running away from them. They really appreciated that. And although we didn't agree on everything, as the weeks, months, and then ultimately years went by, we developed a collaborative relationship that was very, very positive in its impact on how we did clinical trials, mm-hmm. on how the FDA modified their way of looking at things like compassionate usage of drugs. So at the end of the day, it was a very, very positive, value-added experience that started off confrontationally, but turned out to be very collaborative.
Quite a learning curve, though, for you, because I think it's important for all us to collectively remember really how intense the despair was of the gay community then, because, I mean, like, entire communities were being wiped out. I mean, you mentioned in your book, in the book On Call, that when you went to Greenwich Village, you were horrified. Because as you walked around the streets there, you were literally seeing young men who were skeletons. They were walking death, essentially, because there was so much AIDS in the community. And I think that's one of the reasons why, I mean, as you said, many AIDS activists felt that they had to be outlandish, confrontational, dramatic, as you said, because they weren't being heard. And I want to play another example of that. This is a voice that you know very well. It's the late Larry Kramer, AIDS activist and founder of ACT UP, who early on was fearless in the media of calling you a pill pusher, calling you incompetent. The two of you later became friends because you reached out to him. But I want to play a bit of Kramer from 1991 so that people can hear the kind of fiery passion that he'd often aim at you and actually presidents alike.
Plague! 40 million infected people is a plague! And nobody acts as it is, as if it is. 40 million people is a plague! Nothing is working. None of that you saw on that screen is working. Nothing, none of the that is in the pipeline that these people are studying is working. You heard what George Bush said when we went to Kennebunkport. He's more inclined he feels more sorry for the unemployed. That's what we're in.
That's Cramer in 1991. Now, here's the question I want to ask. I mean, we could just talk about that, though, Cramer, for a long time. But what I'm trying to learn from you this hour, Dr. Fauci, is how your experiences working on HIV/AIDS later on informed how you handled, you know, the other transformative epidemic that the world experienced with COVID. Because in hearing Cramer's passion there, many times when you had to testify on Capitol Hill regarding COVID, you encountered passion also. I'm not going to ever make an equivalence between, you know, Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene and Larry Cramer. That's not what I'm doing. But in terms of how to respond and handle people who are extremely passionate and care a lot about a particular issue that you're studying in public health, how do you handle those moments? What did you learn from your AIDS experience?
Well, the one thing I learned many things, but the one really standout thing that I learned is that when you listen to people, even though they might be confrontative and theatrical in their style, that when I listened to the AIDS activists and heard what they were saying, it became crystal clear to me that what they were saying was making perfect sense. And I immediately came to the conclusion that if I were in their shoes, I would be doing exactly what they were doing. And I would be very, very confrontative and people were not listening to me. And it was that spurred me on to continue to listen to them. And the lesson learned, not only for HIV, but for every other disease, for Ebola, for Zika, for chikungunya, for pandemic flu, and then ultimately for COVID, was that you have to listen to people. You may not agree with them, but you really need to listen. But I really must point out, because you yourself brought it up, the confrontation back with HIV was what I give the analogy. I call upon something that the iconic civil rights leader, John Lewis, said, that we made trouble in the civil rights movement, but it was good trouble. And that's exactly what the activists with HIV did. They made trouble, but it was good trouble. I have to just make sure the audience appreciates that when you fast forward to 2020, 2021, 2022, the attacks on the medical community by some of the extremists, including those in Congress, is not good trouble, because the activists were absolutely correct in trying to get our attention. Whereas the attacks, for example, that you alluded to by people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, that's pure vitriol and pure ad hominem with no productive or value added component to it. So I wouldn't want the listeners to think that there's comparability between the pushback in the 80s by the AIDS activists and the attack on science and scientists that we're seeing today. It's a world of difference.
Yeah, no, agreed. That's why I was trying to just hear from you about, you know, from your perspective as being that person who, for both of these major transformative diseases, you were on that that cusp between the scientific community and the public, right? And so, right. So how you manage both events. Now, similarly, there's the issue, and again, I'm approaching this conversation absolutely from the point of view of the public, Dr. Fauci. And so there's this issue about how the scientific community talks to the public when trying to deal with the uncertainties of new diseases, right? You had to experience that a lot during the HIV/AIDS crisis. So here is a moment with you, again, a very young sounding, I should say, Dr. Fauci, on PBS NewsHour in 1985.
Can you give any kind of an educated guess about how long it might be before some kind of cure is found?
Again, it's very difficult to do that. I can tell you that there are some agents that clearly have been shown to suppress the replication of the virus. This is a very unique virus because even if you block its ability to replicate, it also has the unique ability to hide or live within the cells, such that you might suppress its multiplication, but you might not ever be able to completely rid the body of the virus unless perhaps the body's own defenses come in and do that.
Okay, so the reason why I wanted to play that, Dr. Fauci, is A, you answer a question with a sort of scientific and medical response because in retrospect, that's the right one. Essentially, we don't know. We're still trying to understand it. But the other reason I want to play it is that several decades later, in 2021, April 30th, 2021, another journalist, me, essentially asked you the same question about COVID. And my excuse for not coming up with a better question than you heard on the NewsHour in 85 was I was only 10 years old in 1985. So here's what I asked you on April 30th, 2021, essentially about herd immunity. And when would we know that we'd cross a threshold where COVID would no longer be a danger? I know you've been through the ringer over the past year, but I hear you very strenuously trying to not answer a question here. So let me rephrase it. You're advising the Biden administration.
Yeah.
And certainly the Biden administration, I know they're thinking about these questions because they've got to make announcements. They got to communicate to the people, the CDC, et cetera. What are you advising them on like what they ought to be aiming for regarding getting how we're going to know when COVID is under control?
Well, you know, that's right. And I'm not Magna, I'm smiling because you're saying that I'm trying very hard not to answer your question. I am answering your question. We don't know what that number is. We don't know what a number will be when you're going to have such control that people are going to feel comfortable about going out. I mean, we could give you a real number when there's no infection, when you've actually controlled it so that there are essentially so few infections, you could barely count them. But we don't know if that's going to be the case with the dynamics. So it isn't as if we're avoiding your question. We don't know the precise answer to that.
So that was April 30th, 2021, Dr. Fauci. I have to say, I still stand by my question because people wanted to know the answer to that. But what I want to put to you now is I also think that the scientific community, which I love, and all of my education is actually in science and engineering, hadn't actually learned much, with all due respect, from the AIDS crisis to COVID about how to communicate to the public in the middle of a public health crisis. So I'm wondering if now, listening back to that, if you think there was a better way to talk about how to handle uncertainty when we are still learning the basic dynamics of a disease.
We always could do better, for sure, because we're not perfect and we could always improve upon everything, including or communication. But listening to that clip, as I was smiling, you were saying, you know, you're not answering the question and you still didn't answer it. And I'm saying to myself, because there's no answer.
You should have said that.
Okay. Well, the reason is, I mean, the proof of the pudding is it is now 2024 and we still haven't reached whatever that number of herd immunity is because it doesn't exist for COVID. I got infected a week and a half ago with COVID. I had been vaccinated six times, and this is my third time that I've gotten infected. Thank goodness I recovered quickly because of the help of vaccinations and prior immunity from infection. But the point that now has been absolutely proven is that we were trying to compare COVID back when you asked me that question to things like measles and polio. And to get herd immunity, which is defined for the audience simply as a level of protection in the community, either from vaccination or from prior infection, so that the virus doesn't really have any wiggle room to spread from one person to another. That percentage of the community that needs to be protected to protect the rest of the smaller percentage of the vulnerable community varies from disease to disease. For measles, it's over 90%. And the thing that makes herd immunity feasible for a disease is two factors. One, you have to have a virus or a pathogen that doesn't change, that it stays stable. Measles stays stable. The measles that I was infected with as a child is the same measles that's infecting people in the developing world even today. The second characteristic is that when you get either infected or vaccinated, the duration of the protection is measured minimally in decades and optimally for a lifetime. That's what measles does. No way does COVID do that. A, because we've already experienced multiple variants of COVID, from the original COVID through Alpha, Beta, Delta, Omicron, and multiple variants of Omicron, number one. So the first characteristic is not present. The second characteristic is that we know immunity to COVID is very transient. It's measured in months to a year, testis est. The fact that despite the fact that I've been multiply vaccinated, I got infected a couple of weeks ago. So we have to put aside, and maybe the best way back then, I tried when you answered that question, is I don't know what the number for COVID immunity is, for herd immunity.
Dr. Fauci, hang on for just a second. That's still true. Okay, we got a lot more to talk about COVID when we come back. This is On Point.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Realtors have vacant homes. At Pest Properties, ours come occupied and ready to infest. Looking to relocate your larvae? Try the Petri Residence. This rustic home features thousands of crevices to squirm in through, vaulted ceilings for our wall crawlers, and an outdoor bird bath teeming with mosquito eggs. So kick up your six hairy legs and sign today.
Before pests move in, Terminix it. With over 95 years of experience, we'll help keep your home off the pest market. Visit Terminix.com today.
You're back with On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and Dr. Anthony Fauci joins us today. His memoir is On Call, A Doctor's Journey in Public Service. And Dr. Fauci, if I may, I have to say, when I, back in 2021, when we, from that clip that we played of my interview with you, and even now, when it comes to questions about, again, that land at that intersection between science or infectious disease research and the public part of public health, perhaps it's to be expected, since your whole career has been in medicine, that you answer those questions from the perspective of the research scientist, right? I was just listening to you carefully about, like, you know, the disease dynamics around COVID and why we may never know when total herd immunity is reached because COVID continues to mutate into its various forms. Now, I understand that completely, but I'm not sure that when it comes to a person in your position who was in your or who will be in your position in the future as the head of a major health organization in this country, is that the best way to talk to people? Because I think when a lot of people heard that during COVID, it was just kind of a lot of science talk to them. And all they really wanted to know was, when do I get to get back to my normal life? Yeah. Now, again, drawing from your experiences in communicating not only with people but politicians during the AIDS crisis, how did you learn how to effectively get your message through in the 80s and early 90s that you were either able or unable to use in COVID?
Well, you always got to try and fine-tune and perfect how you communicate. But one of the things that I think we need to realize is the public wants absolutes, understandably. That's not a criticism of them. They want an absolute answer from the scientific community. And they don't appreciate anything that has to do with a moving target. They look at something in a frozen frame. This is what I'm looking at now. Give me an answer. But when you're dealing with something in which there is no absolute and your target is moving, that almost by definition is very difficult to get to the general public to understand. If you want to be perfectly frank and honest, you would say, I don't know the answer to your question. And even if I did, the target is moving and my answer likely will change. That's the absolute proof. This is the answer I have for you now, but it might change. Although that's the truth, the general public will have a hard time accepting that. And most of them will turn around and say, those scientists don't know what the heck they're talking about, which is unfortunate because then they won't listen to anything that comes from the mouth of scientists. So if we have to do a better job, we have to gently and with respect to the public try to convince them that particularly in the early weeks and months of COVID, we were dealing with a moving target. The target was moving for two reasons. One, the information that was coming out first from China and then from the scraps of information we knew from Europe and then ultimately New York City and then the rest of the country was new information each day, each week, each month. So it was brand new. But also, the information was changing because we were dealing with a virus that itself was changing. So you're right. We need to just try as best as we can to get that message to the public without confusing them, that when you're dealing with a moving target, the scientific process, by definition, allows you to collect data, evidence, and information, and then communicate to the public a recommendation, a truth, a fact, a guideline based on the information that you happen to have at that moment.
Right.
When the information changes, we've got to communicate to the public that science is a self-correcting process, which means that if you're true to the science, you've then got to take the information that you now have, which might be different than the information you had a week or a month ago, and change your recommendation, change your guidelines. That's a very tough thing for the public to appreciate.
Well, I also think that our politics are intolerant of uncertainty, right? And so you're trying to have this conversation in a political environment which is preemptively set to not be able to hear it. But that's why I want to just turn for a minute or two to the kinds of conversations and advice and even perhaps advocacy that you had to do behind closed doors to the politicians themselves, because you do write about this in On Call, about the decision that you made to essentially become, let's say, a kind of scientific advocate advocate to the Reagan administration to convince them to give more funding for AIDS research, right? And that led to some pretty significant changes. And I want to just, again, get back and jump back into the Wayback Machine and listen to President Ronald Reagan when he first mentioned AIDS, his very first mention of AIDS. It was 4 years into the epidemic, and it was at a press conference in September of 1985. He was asked by a reporter if he would, quote, support a massive government research program against AIDS, like the one that President Nixon had launched against cancer.
I have been supporting it for more than 4 years now. It's been one of the top priorities with us, and over the last 4 years, and including what we have in the budget for 86, it will amount to over $500 million that we have provided for research on AIDS, in addition to what I'm sure other medical groups are doing. And we have $100 billion or $100 million in the budget this year. It'll be $126 million next year. So this is a top priority with us. Yes, there's no question about the seriousness of this and the need to find an answer.
That's President Reagan in September of 1985. So, Dr. Fauci, here's my question to you. The lessons that you learned in how to be effective when talking to a president or a president's advisors about an infectious disease, were those the same lessons that you applied when talking to former President Trump and his advisors? And were you as effective?
Yeah, the answer is I wasn't as effective with President Reagan as I had hoped to be. I like President Reagan, but I don't think that he, and I think history has proven me to be correct, I don't think he used the bully pulpit or the power of the presidency to the extent that he could have to address this emerging pandemic, this emerging plague, although at the time it was almost specifically among young gay men. It was when I developed a relationship with George H.W. Bush when he was vice president and he was thinking of running for president. I got to know him personally, which was initiated on a visit that he made to the NIH in 1988, right before he declared that he was going to be running for president. And he wanted to learn a lot more about HIV and AIDS. And he asked me to help brief him. And that's when I developed a very strong relationship. And as I describe in the memoir, a really nice friendship with him. It was in the George H.W. Bush administration that we really started to get the major increase in funding for HIV, which then extended into the Clinton administration and then even beyond that. So, yes, developing relationships with people who have influence, obviously no one has more influence than the president of the United States, was very important to me. And the idea of relationships so that when people are needing to get information, you can get it to them directly. That was the lesson I learned way back in the 80s, and it had helped me through multiple administrations, not only with COVID. I mean, the relationship that I developed with President George W. Bush when he asked me to be the primary architect of the PEPFAR program, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, was based not only on his fundamental, ethics and principles of wanting to help people in the developing world, but it had a fair amount to do with the relationships that I developed with not only President George W. Bush, but with the people around him.
What was your relationship with President Trump like?
My relationship with President Trump in the beginning was really very good. Like most people now think, because I had to, after a period of time, publicly disagree with him, that it was inherently an adversarial relationship, which is not the case. In the beginning, in January, February, and March, when I became one of the members of the Coronavirus Task Force and met with him frequently in the White House, we had a very good rapport. And in fact, as I describe in the memoir, it was almost like two guys from New York City, one guy from Queens and one guy from Brooklyn, who kind of had this New York City rapport between them. So I got along very well with him. He listened to what I and Dr. Deb Birx asked him to do about trying to slow down the momentum of the outbreak by flattening the curve. It was only when he wanted so desperately for the outbreak to go away, because it was obviously hurting the economy, and he foresaw very clearly that it was getting in the way of his activities in the election cycle, that he wanted it to go away like magic. So he started to say things that were just untrue, like it's going to disappear like magic, it's just going to go away. Mm. And then when it didn't go away, he started invoking these magical cures like hydroxychloroquine. And it was at that point that I had to do something that I was very uncomfortable, but I had to do it to be true to my own integrity and to my responsibility to the American public. I had to publicly, when asked, publicly say, no, I disagree. It's not going to go away like magic. And no, hydroxychloroquine is not the cure for COVID. In fact, it might even hurt people. It was at that point, as we got into April, May, and June, that not so much the president, but more his staff became infuriated with me. Mm. And with that were his tens of millions of followers on the outside who thought I was undermining, you know, their hero, the president, which I absolutely did not want to do. I had no pleasure in contradicting the president of the United States. I have a great deal of respect for the presidency of the United States, but it's something I had to do. That turned his staff off to me, but surprisingly, it did not really turn him off until very, very late at the end of the year when he started actively campaigning for re-election, that I started to become the real goat in this, not only to him, but to virtually all of his followers.
Well, I'm mindful of the time, Dr. Fauci. It's actually really raced by, so we only have a couple of minutes left. And I want to once again try and see what the connections are between your experience with HIV/AIDS and with COVID. Because earlier in the show, you said that one of the mistakes that you think you and your fellow researchers made at the beginning of the AIDS crisis was when interacting with AIDS activists, sort of giving off this sense of like, we know what's best for you because we've been doing this for a long time. Trust us, we're the scientists. I would say that a lot of Americans felt exactly the same way during COVID. That whether, you know, whether it was intentional or not, that was the message they felt that they were receiving. Trust the science and then, you know, don't ask any questions. You also said that science is self-correcting. And it seems like some people in the scientific and public health community are doing some self-correction themselves. And I want to offer you one example from Dr. Francis Collins, right? Former head of the NIH, good friend and colleague of yours. I think it was just last year, July of last year, he was at a conference for a group called Braver Angels, and he said a couple of interesting things. First of all, he talked about the advice given around lockdowns early in the pandemic, and here's what he said.
As a guy living inside the Beltway, feeling the sense of crisis, trying to decide what to do in some situation room in the White House with people who had data that was incomplete, we weren't really thinking about what that would mean. 1,000 miles away from where the virus was hitting so hard, we weren't really considering the consequences in communities that were not New York City or some other big city.
And then he said why. He explained why the focus was so much on just stopping the disease and not thinking about other aspects of public life.
The public health people, we talked about this earlier, and this is a really important point. If you're a public health person and you're trying to make a decision, you have this very narrow view of what the right decision is, and that is something that will save a life. Doesn't matter what else happens. So you attach infinite value to stopping the disease and saving a life. You attach a zero value to whether this actually totally disrupts people's lives, ruins the economy, and has many kids kept out of school in a way that they never quite require.
Collateral damage.
So there, collateral damage. This is a public health mindset. And I think a lot of us involved in trying to make those recommendations had that mindset. And that was really unfortunate. It's another mistake.
Dr. Fauci, we unfortunately only have a minute left. But I'm wondering, I mean, just frankly, if you could do anything different going back into the early days of the COVID pandemic, what would it be?
Well, I agree with Francis in part, but not entirely. And I've discussed this with him. He's absolutely correct that you can't just completely forget any collateral impact that a decision might have. But you've got to remember, and I'll get back to what my recommendation would be, is that at the time that we had that flattening of the curve or a shutdown, it wasn't really a complete shutdown, but it was close to that, that we were having—
Dr. Fauci, people are going to hate me for interrupting you, but we've only got about 30 seconds, okay?
Okay. Is that shutting down was the right thing to do. What we need to re-examine clearly is how long we kept things closed, because I think that's something that we need to re-examine and make sure that we take into account the potential collaborative damage. But the initial decision was correct decision. The duration of it was something that we need to question.
Well, Dr. Fauci, I have to say, this is obviously just the skimming of the surface of the surface of what you write about in your memoir. It's called On Call, A Doctor's Journey in Public Service. Thank you for joining us today, and thank you for those many decades of public service.
Appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery, innovation, development, and learning in engineering and science. Listen on for a story of how one company is using MathWorks software to help the planet.
The transportation sector is one of the largest contributors of greenhouse gases, and a lot of that is from maritime transport.
Yeah, maritime transport creates a huge amount of carbon dioxide, about 900 million tons annually.
That's Gus Block, Corporate Development Director at Nuvera Fuel Cells, who explains that 90% of all foreign goods are transported through ports and container ships, most of which run on diesel. But Nuvera is working on a way to electrify this system through hydrogen fuel cells.
Hydrogen can make all the difference between being able to electrify those vessels or not.
Cargo ships often travel far distances.
Well, sometimes they're crossing oceans, right?
And hydrogen, the lightest element on the periodic table, is uniquely suited to help power the ship's long journeys.
Fuel cells can take advantage of hydrogen's properties, being something that is quickly refueled, something you can carry on board a vehicle, and be used in places where battery electrification is impractical for one reason or another.
One reason, batteries can be really heavy. Another, batteries can take a long time to charge.
That may be possible for harbor craft or for ferries, for instance, but for long-haul shipping, it's quite a different story. And what hydrogen gets you is the ability to carry much more energy on board than you would otherwise with batteries.
And in addition to powering cargo ships, hydrogen fuel cell technology can be used to power electric trucks, heavy equipment, and also passenger cars. So, how do hydrogen fuel cells work?
A fuel cell is an electrochemical device. Each individual cell in the stack consists of a membrane that separates hydrogen on one side and air on the other.
And as Nuvera chief engineer Pierre-Francois Kay explains, the hydrogen arrives at the membrane, breaks down into protons and electrons, generating power for a motor, all without the need to burn fossil fuels. In fact, they produce no exhaust other than heat and water. But implementation of this technology is no easy feat, with several challenges to overcome.
One of our main challenges that we face is hydration management.
The membrane needs to be hydrated to be permeable to protons, but too much water can cause flooding and the fuel cell will not operate properly.
So with model-based design using MATLAB and Simulink, we created a model of the fuel cell, and that allowed us to simulate our water management controls in a variety of ambient conditions.
Model-based design. I needed to check with someone from MathWorks, the creator of MATLAB and Simulink, to fully understand what's happening.
Well, companies like Nuvera, who are using MATLAB and Simulink, are using it to model and simulate a complex engineered system. For Nuvera, it's a chemical reaction involving hydrogen as a fuel, which then is combined with air to form an electric current and water.
That's Tony Lennon, the Simscape marketing manager at MathWorks, who explains that model-based design allows Nuvera to virtually simulate how the hydrogen fuel cell will operate in real time and to tackle challenges like hydration management virtually before using physical components.
Not using model-based design means that you're going to be out there testing on real hardware. You run the risk of damaging hardware or not thoroughly testing all the operating envelope that the real equipment's going to see.
And operating real hardware can take a lot of time. Pierre-Francois Kay again.
There's a huge advantage to simulate all of these conditions in a virtual environment instead of building systems physically, because those are expensive, and every time we need to change a piece of hardware, it takes time.
Saving this time can mean more innovation and, in the case of Nuvera, more fuel cells to power the clean energy transition.
To learn more about MathWorks and Nuvera, and for more stories, check out wbur.org/mathworks.